Please be seated. Good morning. We're delighted to welcome you all to our April oral arguments. And there's a special welcome today to the students from Loyal School District. Would the students please stand? We have a large group. My notes show 40. Well, thank you for coming. You may be seated. The students are here with a program that is sponsored by the Supreme Court and the State Bar of Wisconsin. The program is cleverly entitled Court with Class. We invite students from around the state to come and listen to an oral argument with us. The students have been given a summary and materials about the case. They may have engaged in special activities relating to the case. They come, they listen to oral argument, and after this oral argument is completed, which would be about 12:15, then the students may be joined by other students who have been here today, and we'll have a discussion about the procedures for deciding which cases to take and deciding the case. Everybody is invited, including counsel. The discussion will be procedural, not relating to the substantive issues of the case. So, if anyone would like a summary of this case, would you raise your hand and we'll provide one? Let me introduce the court to you all. I'm Shirley Abrahamson. I'm the Chief Justice. To my immediate right is Justice Anne Walsh Bradley. Justice Bradley will be the justice with whom he'll meet after this case is decided. On my left is Justice Patrick Crooks. On Justice Bradley's right is Justice David Prosser. On Justice Crook's left is Justice Pat Robinsack. On Justice Prosser's right is Justice Annette Ziegler. And on Justice Robinsack's left is Justice Michael Gableman. I hope you all followed that.
We're impressed. I thought that I'd do something different after 15 years, so that's a good idea.
Actually, we're dazzled.
Do you like it? Dazzled. Dazzled is a better word than impressed.
So that leads us to an impressive and dazzling oral argument. I have set the stage for you gentlemen. In our second case today, 10AP2514CR, State versus Scott E. Ziegler. Arguing on behalf of the defendant, Mr. Ziegler, is attorney Christopher William Rose. Then we'll hear for 30 minutes from Assistant Attorney General O'Neill, and then Mr. Rose, you have 5 minutes of rebuttal. Counsel, you may proceed.
Good morning. Chief Justice Abramson, members of the court, as you know, I'm attorney Christopher Rose. I'm here representing the petitioner, Scott E. Ziegler. I'm with Rose and Rose Attorneys in Kenosha. I was appointed through the Public Defender's Office to represent Mr. Ziegler on appeal. As we know, this case is here on certification from the Court of Appeals. On the issue of the interference with child custody, and that conviction that Mr. Ziegler was convicted of. It's a serious case and a serious matter. There were a number of counts in which Mr. Ziegler was charged within this case. There were 14 of them, actually, and one of which was the interference with child custody statute. It's an important case. It's a serious matter with some far-reaching implications, we'd submit. Ultimately, what Mr. Ziegler is requesting on the at least certification issue is that count be dismissed with prejudice. It's our position that there was insufficient evidence in this case on that count to support the verdict that was obtained here. And ultimately, if that were reversed and dismissed, he would be entitled to a resentencing. There were other issues in this case as well, but I'm going to address the issue that was certified here on the interference with child custody. In this case, we relied on the opinion of State versus Bowden, and State versus Bowden really specifically addresses the issue which is present in Mr. Ziegler's appeal, because it dealt with the interpretation of Section 948.31, subsection 2 of the Wisconsin statutes. And as we know, under that statutory provision, whoever causes a child to leave, that's one of the elements, takes a child away or withholds a child for more than 12 hours from the child's parents, and it goes on, or in the cases of a non-marital child from whose parents do not subsequently intermarry, from the child's mother, or if he has been granted legal custody, the child's father without consent of the parents, the mother or father with legal custody is guilty of a Class I felony. And what we're dealing with specifically in Mr. Ziegler's case is the withholding element of the statute and the withholding element under 948.31, subsection 2. So in the brief that we originally filed with the Court of Appeals, it was our position and remains our position that pursuant to Bowden and pursuant to Section 948.31, that the evidence that was presented at Mr. Ziegler's trial was insufficient to convict him of that statute. And here's why. As we cited to in the Bowden case, Bowden dealt with the situation that's really one of the statutory interpretation of 948.31, subsection 2, and it addressed all three parts of that statute that I just addressed previously. In Bowden, that dealt with a situation where Mr. Bowden had taken two children, and he was ultimately convicted under the statute, not of the withholding element, but the withholding element was addressed in Bowden, and the Court of Appeals said in Bowden that in order to be convicted under the withholding element of the statute, there has to have been by the parent at least some initial permission for the child to have the child by a particular defendant, who in this case is Mr. Ziegler.
Mr. Rose, where do you think they got that from and made it an element when it's not in the statute? The statute doesn't set that forth as a requirement or an element of crime of withholding. Where did the Court of Appeals come up with that?
Well, I think what I think what the Court of Appeals is doing in Bowdoin and was looking at the purpose behind this statute, which is interference with child custody. And so when you look at the statute and the way it's been applied as it was applied in this case, I think that's what the problem is. And I think what they were addressing was, what does withholding mean under a statute which deals with interference with child custody? So when you're withholding a child and there's a custodial situation that's ongoing, there would have to be some type of initial permission of some sort in order for there to be some type of conviction, because I think that's what the statute is aimed at and geared at, it's child custodial situations.
And yet, I think you indicated earlier, and it's my understanding also, that particular provision of the statute was not really at issue in the Bowdoin case. The argument then becomes, well, is it dicta? Is what they were saying there dicta? What's your response?
Well, no, I don't believe it was dicta. And the reason why I don't believe it was dicta is because it was interpreting all three provisions of the statute. It was interpreting not just the causes to leave or taking a child away, but the withholding element as well, in order to come to the conclusion that under the statute, whoever causes a child to leave or takes a child away, therefore, under this statute, if you look at the withholding element, there would have to be some initial permission under that section in order for there to be a conviction here under the two other provisions.
But yet it wasn't necessary, was it, for them to look at the withholding? That wasn't the provision that was at issue.
Well, you're correct. It wasn't the provision that was at issue. When you say it wasn't necessary, they engaged in statutory interpretation, and the reason for the statutory interpretation to support the conviction had to do with looking at the entire statute, which included the causes to the child to leave or taking the child away. So, I mean, to say it isn't necessary, I don't know that I would agree that it isn't necessary, because it did the reasoning supported the conviction, and this was part of its reasoning.
Counsel, I reviewed the briefs, and of course, your briefs are the briefs that were filed in the Court of Appeals before the certification. And oftentimes we see in this court a procedure where we get new briefs or different briefs after it's been to the Court of Appeals and that are specific for the Supreme Court. But we don't have that in this case. And the briefs that were written for the Court of Appeals on this issue fight back and forth or argue back and forth whether or not the language in Bowdoin was dicta. And in fact, that is the underpinning of the state's argument that the Bowdoin language is dicta. In page 11 in their briefs, that's what they say. This is my question. I'm wondering why would this case is here. We now have the certification. The certification is short. But it says in footnote 1, look, we judges on the Court of Appeals who are certifying this to you, Court, Supreme Court, candidly admit that two of the three of us now certifying this were two of the three of us that sat on the Bowdoin decision. And they say in footnote 1 that the reason we came up with this initial permission stuff, in part, was because we adopted the state's argument. And, of course, now the state is expressing a contrary view. But the state was arguing in Bowdoin that initial permission was really an element of that offense. The certification goes on to address the dicta issue, which the parties fought in their briefs to the Court of Appeals. And on page 4, the Court of Appeals certification says, look, they say, in other words, we intentionally took up Bowdoin's argument. We decided it in a manner consistent with the state's position, and therefore it was germane to the issue in controversy. It was also, quote, essential to the determination of the issues before us. So this is the majority of the Court of Appeals in Bowdoin saying it was essential to our determination in Bowdoin. Then they say in their last paragraph, look, we think we wrongly decided Bowdoin. But because of a case that exists in the state of Wisconsin called Cook versus Cook, we can't overrule it. So we're certifying this case to you. When we took up the issue and we considered it an essential issue, adopting the state's argument that initial permission was part of it, that's what we did. That's what we held. But now we think it's wrong. My question is this. If the defendant committed a crime when the law in effect in the state of Wisconsin was Bowdoin, even if we would say now that initial permission is not an element of the offense and overrule or get rid of that language in Bowdoin, what law governs? Isn't it the law that was in effect at the time of the commission of the crime, or am I wrong?
So your question is, if in fact Bowdoin were overruled, should that apply to Mr. Ziegler's case?
Well, what controls? I mean, the Court of Appeals and their certification answered, from their perspective, what was going on in Bowdoin. The whole fight in your briefs is Bowdoin dicta, is it not dicta? They very clearly said it's not dicta. They very, very clearly analyzed it in pages 3 and 4 and said it was essential to our holding.
They very clearly say now, oops, we think we made a mistake, and because of Cook versus Cook, we can't undo our mistake. Only the Supreme Court can. So please take a look at it, court. That's what they say. My question is, now that they've said it, and you haven't briefed this because your briefs are, predate the certification, what law is in effect? Even if we agree with the state now that initial permission is not an element of the offense, what law was in effect at the time of the commission of the crime, and is that law controlling? And I ask that as a question. Is that the controlling law?
It's clearly Bowdoin wasn't at the time of the commission. I mean, I don't think that's disputed.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know that it can answer the question as to whether or not if it's reversed, because our position is it should not be reversed and it should be upheld. And I think if you look at the statute and the interference with child custody statute, I think it goes right along the lines of what, as I stated earlier, it should be, because it deals with custodial situations.
I understand that's your argument. That's the argument in your briefs before the Court of Appeals weighed in into the issue, which was the central argument and contest in your briefs as to whether or not it was dicta or essential to the holding.
I mean, my answer would be Bowdoin would apply. That's what our position is. I mean, it's our position that this court should uphold it. It's our position it applied at the time, and I think it's sound reasoning. Why did they certify it? I mean, it is true that the state did take a contrary position in this case as opposed to Bowdoin. They can answer that question better than I, why they took the contrary position, although I would note in their brief, there is a footnote in their brief which indicates that, in fact, in most situations, if not virtually all situations, in fact, the withholding element as it's applied in Bowdoin would be exactly the case.
Now that the Court of Appeals has weighed in, why do you care if we overruled Bowdoin or not, if it was the law in effect at the time that the crime was committed, and I'm not sure, if that's the law that would then control. What difference does it make?
You know, from the defendant's perspective, I suppose it doesn't make a difference if this court, in fact, did not uphold it, but it was a law at the time, and that's what's applied, because in his situation, it clearly would result in that conviction being vacated. But it's still our position that, in fact, it's sound law and should be upheld, and that they were absolutely correct at the time. And I go back to the argument I made about this statute, the interference with child custody, and I think the point here and the problem is that I think the way it's being utilized in cases in Mr. Ziegler's situation is that what we're really talking about is not a situation that is a custodial type of disagreement or a custodial situation in which it's clearly there are competing sides and there's a father and a mother who's taking a child away or withholding a child against a court-ordered period of physical placement.
But it doesn't say that. It just says withhold a child for more than 12 hours from the child's parents.
Well,
let me ask you, what were the instructions in this case? What did the jury instructions say?
What did the jury instructions say?
This is a jury trial, right?
Yeah, correct.
So yeah, the trial court had to tell the jury what this statute is. Or did it add the words from Bowdoin? Didn't it add the words from Bowdoin?
No,
doesn't
I don't
it
believe
matter?
So.
Okay.
No.
My next question is, look at 948.31.1b in the statutes.
Right.
That statute is a child F felony, which is a more serious felony than the one that your client was charged and found guilty of, which is 948.31 sub 2. 948.31.1b says, whoever intentionally, that word is not in 2, right?
Correct.
So I might ask you about mens rea here, but we'll talk about that. So the language now looks like 2. Causes a child to leave. That's exactly what 2 says. Takes a child away or withholds a child for more than 12 hours. And here's we've got a difference. In B, it says beyond the court-approved period. 2 says from the child's parents and then deals with if it's non-marital and legal custody, et cetera. And then, so those are the three mens actus, the three conduct, right?
Mm-hmm.
Causes a child to leave, takes a child away, they're the same in B and in 2. The third one, withholds a child, B deals with legal custody without the consent of the custodian. 2 goes on when it talks about parents, non-marital parents, child's mother if given legal custody, child's father, etc. All of those sound like a fight between parents or an attempt to take the child away from the home contrary to the wishes of the parents. And I suggest that when you look at sub B and you look at subsection 2, when you read them together, and you have to do things in context, and that the concept is that they're very similar crimes, one higher or more serious than the other, that's why, although Bowdoin didn't say this, why Bowdoin says 2 means that's the kind of fight you're dealing with, the kind of fight that is in sub B and that is related to the parents. You going to buy that argument?
I'm sorry?
Are you going to buy that argument?
Well, I would say yes. I mean, I think it goes back to the issue of statutory interpretation. It still deals with custodial situations, whether it's between parents, court-ordered periods of physical placement, or otherwise. And I think that's really the issue here. And so, from our perspective and our position here, when you're looking at the statute and the withholding element, and withholding a child for more than 12 hours, I think when you look at that and you're saying, well, what is the issue there? There has to be something within that withholding element, I think, that has to show why that withholding element is in any way related to the parents or the father or the mother in a custodial situation. And the only way that it would make any sense is if, in fact, was some type of permission initially granted. Otherwise, how can you withhold?
You know what bothers me about the statute and applying it to your client, and I'm going to ask the state the same question. As I understand the state, all that's needed for conviction under subsection 2 is the victim was under 18. The victim's mother hadn't given the victim permission to be at the defendant's residence, right? And 3, the victim was at the defendant's residence for longer than 12 hours, right? So I've got a 17-year-old, and he goes, we can make it either way. We can make it that he goes to the home of another 17-year-old, or he goes to the home of a 19 or 20-year-old to hang out. I did not give him permission to do that. He was to go to school, and the usual course of events, he comes home for dinner. He doesn't. And he's there with the 19-year-old or another 17-year-old. And this is at Ann Walsh Bradley's home. And she feeds him, my kid. Is she liable under 2?
Well, technically.
Is her 17-year-old liable under 2? Or if it's a 19-year-old, is her 19-year-old liable under 2?
Well, technically, I'd say the answer could be yes, and that's the problem. And so but what we're dealing with, of course, is the withholding element, and that's why I initially said initial permission and a custodial type of relationship with the parent. And that's, I think, one of the problems, frankly.
Well, and you can embellish on my fact situation. My 17-year-old tells her 19-year-old, I don't want to go home. had a bad brawl with my mom or dad or both or sibling. I don't want to go home. I want to stay here overnight. They may or may not tell Miss Bradley that. And the kid stays overnight, and it's over there for 12 hours. Is that covered by the statute? The problem is it looks over-inclusive for me.
Well,
and no intent is needed.
I do see that, yes. No intent is needed. That's correct. I think the only difference here in that factual situation, though, is that Justice Bradley didn't know or didn't have that information.
Right, but her kid did. Is he liable?
Is the child liable?
Her 17-year-old keeps my kid at the house. Is her 17-year-old liable in the statute? Or 19-year-old?
Possibly. Could be.
Don't you think that happens with some frequency during the tumultuous years of being in high school?
Yeah.
Sometimes kids get upset with their parents, and sometimes they go over to a friend's house for more than 12 hours.
Or
they go camping in the backyard with, overnight.
Yeah, I don't disagree with any of those points, and I guess this goes back to prosecutorial discretion. I mean, even if you look at this case, this was a 14-count information.
Well, I'm looking at elements of the offense. I want to look at the statute. Is what I described, is that covered? Is that an offense under the statute, or how does that fit in, following up the chief's comments?
Well, I think that's one of the problems. It could. It could under those factual situations that were just described. Of course, again, I'm dealing with the withholding element, but under those situations it could. And I think, when you're looking at the statute, that's why I think the interpretation here about the initial permission is the key. And that's why I think it was correct when Bowden was initially decided about interference with child custody.
You know, the example I gave, at least to me, would say, hey, that's not what the legislature intended, and it doesn't fit the statute. But it does. Plain words of the statute fit the example I gave you. Your client is not a 17-year-old or a 19-year-old. And your client kept children more than 12 hours, right, against their wish?
Well, I don't know that I agree with that it was
okay.
Kept them against their wish.
Well,
no.
Did they withhold? Jury found under instructions they withheld a child for more than 12 hours, right?
Right.
More than 12 hours, you can see that?
Yes.
Okay. Did the mother know where the child was or the father? Did the children want to be released?
No.
They didn't want to go home?
Well, I mean, this was a runaway situation. So they were with Mr. Ziegler for a period of time, and obviously there was more than one, but that's what the situation was. I mean, at some point, is it certainly possible that they wanted to? Yes, but this was not a situation in which it wasn't a kidnapping situation. It was a runaway situation. And so, I mean, that's what factually happened here in Mr. Ziegler's case.
Could the DA, I mean, this, for me, those are bad facts.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, your client didn't do so good. But that's not the question, whether he did so good or that's good behavior. The question is whether it's criminal. Is there another statute they could have charged him with?
Well, I suppose if he really did withhold, I mean, there's a possibility of kidnapping or something along those lines, but that wasn't the factual situation that was presented. And furthermore, as I stated earlier, this was a 14-count information. So, I mean, frankly, under the circumstances, at least as far as the interference goes, and I see I have to stop, as far as the interference goes, it was charged. I don't exactly know why it was charged, but it wasn't really necessary to the case. There are other issues in the case which I can address.
You're going to stand on your briefs on those issues?
At this time, yes.
Thank you. You have 5 minutes in rebuttal.
That was the right answer.
The court's aware of the other issues, and you have them in your briefs. And the certified issue was the significant one, although we will decide all of the issues. Aaron O'Neill, Assistant Attorney General representing the state of Wisconsin.
Thank you, Your Honor. Counsel? And may it please the court, I'm Assistant Attorney General Aaron O'Neill representing the state. State is asking this court to affirm the defendant's conviction for interference with child custody because his actions violated the plain language of the statute prohibiting that crime. The obstacle to this court reaching this decision is the Court of Appeals decision in Bowdoin, which interpreted the withholds more than 12 hours method of violating this statute to contain a requirement that the defendant have initial permission to have the child when he or she withholds the victim from her parents' custody. The state is asking this court to first conclude that this language is an incorrect interpretation of the statute, and second, to either conclude that the language is dicta or withdraw that language from Bowdoin. On the first issue of whether this Court of Appeals correctly interpreted the statute in Bowdoin, it's the state's position that the Court of Appeals decision is simply wrong and an incorrect interpretation of the statute.
Are you stopped from arguing that, since that the contrary was your argument in Bowdoin when they adopted the initial permission element that you advanced?
I don't think we would meet the legal requirements for an estoppel, for the defendant to make an estoppel claim, since they're different parties and interests here. But I think also the Court of Appeals perhaps overstated our argument in Bowdoin. I went back and reviewed the state's brief, and I can assure this court we did not intend to mean that there should be an additional element added to the crime, this initial permission. I think we were, again, as I said in my brief, speaking to what I think the typical situation would be in this case. As I said, the language in Bowdoin does contain no initial permission requirement, and Bowdoin just winds up adding language to the statute and winds up adding an element to the crime, which is something that the Court of Appeals really had no reason to do. There was no constitutional challenge to the statute in Bowdoin such that the court had to construe it in a way to keep it from being found unconstitutional.
Counsel, if it is, as you say, that Bowdoin adds an element to the crime, was that the law then in effect at the time that the crime was committed? And if it was, what is the rule of law as to what law should govern this conviction?
If the language in Bowdoin is interpreted to add an element to the crime, I think that then it depends whether that language is dicta. If it's dicta, even though perhaps the interpretation seems to add an element to the crime, if it's dicta, it could not be construed as actually adding an element to the crime. If it's part of the holding, then yes, I think arguably it did add an element to the crime. And the jury instructions here, which I believe were the pattern instruction, don't contain any discussion of the Bowdoin. There's a reference to Bowdoin, but it doesn't contain any discussion about this issue. And arguably, yes, the law at the time the jury should have been instructed on that issue if that indeed was part of Bowdoin's holding. I honestly hadn't thought of this issue when I was getting ready for this argument, and if this is something the court would like more briefing on, I'd be happy to provide a brief.
Counsel, the usual rule of law is that the jurisprudential review is that the law is always constant. It's the courts and lawyers who make mistakes. And that this statute was in effect at the time of the trial. And if it was misinterpreted at that time, it's because at that time it was wrong.
Yep.
Right. So it's not a matter of whether it's retroactive or prospective.
No.
This interpretation. It's retroactive. It's always, once the court says, hey, this is how you interpret the statute, that means that's the way you interpret it all the time.
Right.
I mean, that's the general rule.
So when the Court of Appeals interprets a statute, mm-hmm. that's the law at the time. Is that, I know what the chief is advancing, but I know that there are two avenues of two schools of thought on that, and that the interpretation that was in effect at the time of the crime is committed may or may not control. Mm-hmm. The other argument is, look, I don't care what the law was, I shouldn't say quite that, regardless of how the Court of Appeals construed it, and of course, their decisions are law until changed, that when we interpret, just like when they interpret, that interpretation, the argument is the interpretation that should have attached from the very beginning. And from time and violet.
Counsel, you heard the example I gave.
Yes.
Of the 17-year-olds, or the 17 and 19-year-old.
Yeah.
They fall within your interpretation of the statute?
They wouldn't.
It would.
It would, because yes. As you pointed out, there is no intent element in sub 2. There is in sub 1B. So I think that there's a distinction there. And I think the jury instruction, I think, actually references that there is no intent element.
Right. So my question to you is that the ordinary rule of law is where you have a criminal statute, where there's a significant penalty. What's the penalty for this?
I think it's a Class I felony.
It's a Class I. Yeah. What's the penalty? Prison.
Yes, can be.
More than a year.
Yes.
The usual rule is that there's a requirement of mens rea.
Yes.
And in numerous cases, some cases, where the statute is a felony and the statute does not provide for mens rea, the court has read mens rea into it, right?
Yes.
In fact, that's kind of ordinary interpretation. Doesn't mean it's done all the time. But here, where the statute covers so much material, so many fact situations, right? To criminalize that behavior as a felony with prison looks like the statute is over-inclusive and can criminalize behavior that is not really societally harmful. And obviously, Bowdoin and the state in the Bowdoin case had a need to limit this statute so it did not become overly inclusive. Does that make sense to you?
I don't think that was actually the intent of our argument. Okay. In Bowdoin. I think we were just attempting to respond.
I didn't check the briefs. Yeah.
Yeah, it was more of an attempt to respond to the defendant's attempt to distinguish the, on the one hand, the causes to leave and takes away, and the other withhold for more than 12 hours, where he said it had to do with whether the child was in the parent's presence, mm-hmm. and the state argued, no, really, that what we're talking about is the initial permission.
Well,
I don't think
substituted permission for presence.
Yes.
He put in something, because it seems to me there's a need for a limiting construction here. Why shouldn't the court say that this felony requires mens rea, an intent, and that this statute, it's not permission, that's not in the statute. It doesn't follow a 1B,
no.
So they must have been something else, although you could argue that the concepts are very, very similar with 1B. They're trying to do something to limit this. And that the concept that you ought to put in is an intent to keep the child away from the parent. And that that would limit it being overly inclusive. Now, if I were the state, I'd argue that it doesn't then meet with behavior that is bad. But I have a sense that you could find a statute that would cover this kind of activity.
Yes, I think.
Other than this statute.
I think that there, I off the top of my head, contributing to the delinquency of a minor comes to mind, given what, under the facts of this case at least, that there was, you know, drugs and alcohol at the defendant's house, but that is a misdemeanor, I believe.
So why don't you want to read in mens rea?
Well, it's not in the language of the statute.
Absolutely not there. Court has done that.
And I think when the legislature passed the statute, they were trying to protect a parent's right to custody of their child from interference by another person, that regardless of whether the person intended to keep the child away, I think the legislature was trying to protect a parent's right to custody of their child, to have control and to, you know, control where their child goes and who they're with. And regardless of whether the person intends to violate the statute, you know, the person, perhaps if a minor is over, in your example, at someone's house, maybe it's incumbent on the adult in that situation to ask, do you have permission to be here? I think the legislature was trying to protect the parental rights in their children and custody and control of their children.
Is the child who runs away guilty of this statute? That child caused the child to leave. That child caused the child to be out more than 12 hours.
Perhaps that's could be an application of the statute. I think that it would be unlikely that a child would ever be charged for this. But, yeah, I think maybe.
How are we going to teach him a lesson not to stay away more than 12 hours unless we charge him? That ought to bring him up short.
I don't know. It might teach a child a lesson, but I don't think. It would depend. I think really what it comes down to is prosecutorial discretion.
Oh, I understand that, but the point of the matter is, does the statute give the prosecutor that discretion? That's the issue before our court, right?
Well, the prosecutor always has discretion on which charges to bring, as long as they fit the facts of the statute.
Only if a statute makes it a crime.
Right, correct.
So if this is not a crime without mens rea, there's no prosecutorial discretion.
Don't have to bring the charges in the first place. That's the discretion. I mean, I don't.
That's right.
Yes.
And the charge they bring has to fit within the statute.
That's right. And I think in the scenario that you pose with the son going over to Justice Bradley's house, there could be charges.
Against her 17-year-old.
Against her 17-year-old. Against her if she's involved.
Well, she's involved.
Let's keep it at the 17-year-old. Okay.
Yeah. She's involved. She may not know the kid is not supposed to go home. She's going to feed him. No intent is needed here.
Yes.
Going to give him food and going to say, well, sure, I'll set up the sofa. You can stay the night. Not knowing anything about.
Well, I think the legislature, again, was trying to protect the rights of you and your child against being interfered with and knowing, being able to know and control where your child is at all times.
Could I ask... Bowdoin is a 2007 decision on 2003 facts. Have there been any changes to the statute that are relevant to our consideration of this matter?
Not that I'm aware of.
For example, it is now a Class F felony.
Pardon me?
It's now a Class F felony.
Oh, it is.
I mean, is there, well, let me just put it point blank. Why shouldn't this statute be fairly narrowly interpreted? I mean, why do we need to have it? I mean, if somebody has children, whether it's parents or whether an agency of some sort has custody of children, and there's any kind of an effort to deprive custodial interest of the children, that seems to me pretty darn serious. But now the statute seems to me interpreted much broader than that. Why?
Well, I agree that it's a broad interpretation of the statute that we are proposing, but I think the reason we are proposing it is because of the facts in this case. There are, I think, I share the concerns, I guess I should say, about charging people for relatively innocuous behavior, but the behavior in this case was not innocuous. And criminal statutes are sometimes broad, and they apply to a variety of situations. And I think that in this case, that's just not inappropriate for the defendant to be charged with interference with child custody.
The title of the statute talks about custody. Interference with custody by parents or others. Is the kind of conduct that the defendant engaged in really covered by that statute, in your view, without a very broad interpretation of it?
Are you asking, did he interfere with the mother's custody in this case? Yeah, absolutely. The mother of the child has a right to custody and control of the child. The child gone, and the child left, went to the defendant's house, and the defendant harbored her for several days. That deprived the mother of her right to custody of her child and interfered with her rights as a parent.
This defendant was not a very nice person and seems to have done a lot of things, but let's suppose a child ran away and took some money with him or her so that the child was able to pay for a motel bill for 2 weeks. All right. Is the motel in any way going to be culpable under this statute? I mean, should they have inquired, hey, this is just a juvenile. What's the authority for this juvenile to be here?
I think, again, under the interpretation that we are putting forth, the motel could be liable for withholding a child from her parent. If the motel knew that the child was under 18 and it was there without the parent's consent.
Where does it say that in the statute?
The child has to be under 18. There has to be, and there's a lack of consent by the parent.
So the elements, to follow up Justice Prosser's question, to hold a hotel liable, what are the elements that could have to be shown under your interpretation of the statute in order to hold a hotel liable?
Maybe I should backtrack on this a little bit.
Good idea.
I agree. It's a very broad situation. I think it has to be. There has to be withholds for more than 12 hours under 18 and lack of consent.
Withholds, 12 hours. Under 18, and when you say withholds, what does that mean? I mean, if you're just, I want to stay a little bit with this hotel just to see if it works. And
it means
it
that the defendant keeps the child away from the parent.
But there's no intention. So if the defendant under the statute without intention houses the child for more than 12 hours, does that fit under the elements?
It may not. If the defendant gets to keep the child away from the parents.
Well, then you're putting in intent. You have to have knowledge and intent. But the statute has neither knowledge or intent, and 1B does. 1B says whoever intentionally withholds a child for more than 12 hours. I'm reading intentionally to cover all three. Maybe you don't read it that way, but I do. And 939 defines knowing, right?
Mm-hmm.
Last time I looked. And it defines intentional, right?
Yes.
And neither word is used. And the statutes in 939 say that if any form of these words, knowing or intentional, are used, then this is what they mean. But it's not there.
No, it's not.
And that's why you get into the 17-year-old and 19-year-old, and that's why you get into Justice Prosser's hotel.
Yes.
They could stay at the Motel 6, is that, for a long time, maybe.
Could I ask, is a runaway agency required to tell the parents where the child is?
I can't answer that question. I don't know. Are you suggesting that a social services agency could be convicted of this crime if they were housing a runaway child?
Well, I mean, kids run away.
Yes.
Okay. They could end up with some bad actors, like someone here. They could go to an agency that deals with runaway kids. Now, if the agency doesn't inform the parents, they don't know where the child is. They're not going to be any happier about being deprived of the child if the agency doesn't inform them.
No. I don't know if there would be criminal liability. I don't know if the agency is required to tell the parents. I acknowledge that we are proposing a very broad interpretation of the statute, and I think the answer to your concerns really has to be is prosecutorial discretion. Is a prosecutor going to charge someone who just goes over to their friend's house and stays there for more than 12 hours, even if the parent complains? Is the prosecutor going to charge a motel owner for having an underage person staying in one of their rooms? Or is the prosecutor going to charge a social services agency for the way they deal with a runaway child? And I think the answer, in most cases, I would hope would be no, but you know, the bad
committing a crime and being charged with a crime are two different things.
That's right.
Do you think that the legislature intended to criminalize this kind of behavior, this hotel behavior?
I don't know. The intent of the legislature is best determined from their language, and under the language, I think that, and the way withholds is interpreted, I think that the intent could be to the possibility of criminal charges in those circumstances.
So is the state going to suggest to the court a limiting interpretation, or does the state think that this statute should be interpreted without a mens rea and include the kinds of examples that the court has hypothetically posed?
We are not asking for a limiting interpretation. I'm not asking that for, I guess, a couple of reasons. First, I don't think that for the facts of this case, I don't think that there needs to be any limiting interpretation. I think that the defendant here, I think, arguably acted intentionally when he withheld the minor, so I don't think that the court really needs to resolve whether that needs to be written into the statute. But again, it's just the legislature knows how to write an intent requirement into a statute. It did it in 1B. It didn't do it in sub 2. I don't. And if this court's going to, if court were to write a limiting insert an intent requirement into the statute and then give its examples, it becomes a question of where you draw the line.
Mm-hmm.
And that line is best drawn by the legislature and then by prosecutors in exercising their discretion.
Mr. O'Neill, under the present statute, I just pull out the statute book. In the old statute, whoever causes a child to leave, takes a child away, or withholds a child. The present one, it says, whoever intentionally causes a child to leave, takes a child away, or withholds a child for more than 12 hours. I mean, this is what we are going forward. I think what you're asking us is to interpret something that isn't the law anymore and to put an interpretation on that the legislature no longer embraces.
Where are you seeing the intentional?
948.31b.
1B.
1B.
That's not the charge of this case, is it?
No,
the charge
is under sub 2, which doesn't contain the intentional language.
Have we got the wrong statute here?
Yep.
2.
Question to counsel does the justice have the wrong statute?
I believe yes, you do. And the subsection we're dealing with does not contain any requirement of intent. In the event that the court agrees with me that the Court of Appeals decision in Bowdoin is incorrect, the question becomes what to do about it. And I think there are two options that this court could follow. One, it could conclude that the language in Bowdoin is dicta and that it doesn't bind this court or the Court of Appeals. The other option is that the court could withdraw the language if it concludes it's part of the holding, or it can just assume that it's part of the holding in Bowdoin and withdraw the language without resolving whether it's dicta. In order to withdraw the language, the court has to determine that the not only was the Court of Appeals mistaken in Bowdoin, but that its decision was objectively wrong. And for that, I point to this court's decision in Duangmala in 2002 and Grady in 2007. And that's the standard for withdrawing a statutory interpretation by the Court of Appeals. Stare decisis would normally follow, require this court to follow a published holding of the Court of Appeals. And for many of the reasons, I think that the decision in Bowdoin, the interpretation of the statute in Bowdoin was wrong. I think it also was objectively wrong because it purports to add language to the statute that's not there and purports to add an element to the statute that's not there. If this court, however, wants to conclude it's dicta, I think this court could also reach that conclusion, applying really either definition of dicta that the Court of Appeals referenced in its certification. The issue of whether initial permission is required was simply not germane to the issue raised in Bowdoin, which was whether the causes to leave method of interference with child custody required the child to be in the parent's presence at the time the withholding occurred. The language also extends beyond the facts of the case and is broader than necessary to decide the issue in that case, which again was the causes to leave version of the interference with child custody.
Should the state not prevail, what's the remedy here?
The remedy would be to vacate the defendant's conviction for interference with child custody.
And?
And
new trial on that issue? Resentencing on the issue?
If the evidence is insufficient, the state can't retry him. That's the law. And I don't think there would be any need for resentencing. The defendant received a shorter concurrent sentence on this charge. I think there were 14 charges, counts 1 through 9. The sentences were made concurrent. Counts 10 through 15 were made concurrent to each other, and then those two sets of charges were made consecutive to each other. And the sentence, I believe, for the interference with child custody was 3 years total, and I know at least one of the sentences, I believe, was 20 years on one of that first set of charges. So there would be no change to a sentence if this
was vacated. What was the instruction here?
What instruction was given?
With regard to the withholding.
The standard.
Which is?
Jury section. It just says withholds. I don't believe it defined withholds at all.
Just the words of the statute.
Yes.
So it didn't add the element of either intentional or the element of Bowdoin.
No. Unless there are any further questions.
Why is that a sufficiency of the evidence question, which would vacate, and you can't retry because that would be a double jeopardy? I understand. That's
yes.
Your position. I understand that. Why isn't it just an error? You should have given the Bowdoin instruction.
What the law really was that at the time.
Yeah.
And it should have been an element of the crime, and that isn't part of the correct interpretation of the statute,
right.
Then I think that instruction should have been given, and he wasn't convicted. The defendant essentially wouldn't have been convicted of a crime because the state failed to prove one of the elements.
A legal error, and they're up here on appeal, so they've waived any double jeopardy, if that's what that is, that way you recast this. I'm just trying to put it.
Yeah, well, I think
pieces in place.
I didn't argue waiver of this issue because it is a sufficiency of the evidence issue, and this court's decisions say you can't waive the sufficiency of the evidence.
But you treat it as a sufficiency.
I did.
And so if you lose on that issue, he's he's only convicted of
13 other charges.
13 other charges.
Yes, and I don't believe there would be a need for resentencing.
You don't think it has to be resentenced?
No, because it was a shorter concurrent sentence to several other sentences. His prison term wouldn't change. Thank you.
Any other questions? All right. Counsel?
Excuse me. Well, I think there's several points here and need addressing from our perspective, and I think the a couple points that were brought out by the Assistant Attorney General, and it's this broad interpretation. I think that's the whole problem. And the other is the prosecutorial discretion. And now I did mention that when I was giving my argument based upon the facts. And it is true that under some set of circumstances, not unlike the facts that were presented in that example, that maybe a prosecutor would make that decision, obviously not to charge under that situation. However, there are also some questions regarding housing a minor and or an agency and whether or not they could be convicted under the statute. And I think the answer to that question under the set of facts is presented is they could. And I think that's the problem with this broad interpretation.
I think we kind of got you all a little far afield because Wisconsin Statute 48.227 talks about runaway homes, children staying there without the permission of their parents, and the obligations that such a home would have in regard to notifying social services, who then gets in touch with the parent, but the child can still stay until there's a hearing. So I wouldn't go down that road too far. I think that the legislature has thought about it in regard to runaway teenagers. I think that maybe they've taken care of some of the concerns that were brought up.
Yeah, that may be correct. But it still goes back to the idea of housing and the issue of withholding. But I do say this about, you know, the issue of prosecutorial discretion. I mean, it is true they're really allowed almost unfettered discretion in charging crimes. And I think that's, frankly, the problem from the defendant's perspective, and it's the problem in this case, and it could be a problem in the future going forward. And if you, whether this court decides to read into the mens rea and make intent a part of it and or look to Bowdoin regarding the withholding element and the issue of initial permission, either way, there was no intent. And there was no permission, initial permission. And so bottom line is, under this statute, the interference with child custody, Mr. Ziegler could not be convicted. And it was a sufficiency of the evidence argument that we made for a very simple reason that it didn't apply to his situation. And even if you read the statute itself, it deals with interference with child custody. The Assistant Attorney General said that it's supposed to protect parental rights, and as to their custody and control of their children. Well, that's the whole point. This situation had absolutely nothing to do with those issues. And as I said before, this was a runaway situation. And in fact, there was no intent in terms of trying to withhold the child from the parent of this case, of the complainant, whose mother did, in fact, testify at the defendant's trial. And, in fact, there was absolutely no knowledge of who Mr. Ziegler was and who the complainant's mother was, and so there was no communication between those parties. So, you know, the bottom line is that is the insufficiency of the evidence argument here that we're making, and if that's the case, that count would have to be dismissed with prejudice and he couldn't be retried. The other issue, though, on the issue of the resentencing, I think what I'm hearing is, frankly, because some of these were concurrent sentences, et cetera, that it really doesn't matter. Well, I couldn't disagree more with that. It does matter. It's a felony count to which he was convicted of, and if it's vacated, leaving him with 13 others, although I would submit, again, there are three other arguments we've made in this case asking for various forms of relief, which I haven't really addressed here, but have addressed in the briefs adequately. But it isn't just simply, well, it's concurrent, so what? I mean, that, I think, flies in the face of resentencing arguments. It could be a new factor, and it's a new factor in that there's one less count that he's sentenced on. So I don't agree that there wouldn't be any need for resentencing or any need to go back to the trial court and say, look, we don't have 14 counts anymore, we have 13. I think it is significant, substantial, and I do think it's relevant. So the broad interpretation that was that the state is actually asking for here, I think, is the exact problem that's germane to the issue, and it's exactly the reason why we raised it. And I see I've run out of time, but we are asking for more relief than just the interference with child custody statute.
Any further questions? Hearing none, I want to thank both counsel for an interesting argument on statutory interpretation of a criminal statute. Thank you, Mr. Rose, representing the defendant, Scott Ziegler, and thank you, Mr. O'Neill, representing the state of Wisconsin. That concludes our hearing on 10 AP 2514CR, State versus Ziegler. The court is in recess until 1:30 when it will hear its third case today. The students, if they can, should remain, and Justice Bradley will be out shortly to talk with you, and I see there are other students who wish to come in. We are in recess.